So the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation. So I'll finish tonight with a little bit more thought on protests and student protests. But I'm trying my best to put this in a context which goes a little deeper than the superficial, that gouges deeper. And of course, it takes a little time because you introduce one layer and then it's got to go systematically. And then how things connect. To me, this is the imagination of it. I mean, this might be familiar over here. This might be familiar over here. You've heard about both of them. But what happens when you connect them and talk about the relationships? And that's what Kant has difficulty happening in other contexts, because we're specializing. As I see it, you know, we're trying to reintegrate the world. I mean, what a pretentious, you know, preposterous thing. But now with Google, with the internet, with all of this information easily accessible, we don't need to have, like, the German system. You know, each specialist, like when I started in, you know, the PhD world, getting a PhD, aspiring after a PhD, your file cards were everything. Eh? So that was your capital. You make your file cards and you become an expert in this, and you keep all the information. You put it on file cards, and then so you go down the hall in a university, in a German university, for instance, and each office has the file cards on every subject. So you've got your civilization there. You've got your basic knowledge of civilization. But what happens when you get beyond those file cards, and those file cards are all now on the internet, and maybe they're not all yet on the internet, and there's lots of stuff that you can't find on the internet that is part of human knowledge, but it's going so fast. It's just the digitalization of information. Have you seen Google Earth and on, like each one of these things, they just, you know, you have the whole information of the maps of the world, actually photographs, and you navigate, you want to go into Lethbridge Galt Gardens, you want to pull back to see what Alberta looks like, you want to zoom over and see what New York looks like, you want to zoom in and see what precinct number 7 police station looks like, you want to whip over to the other side of the Atlantic and see what, I mean, we should be doing that right now, and we will do that. This whole specialization approach, which is the whole structure that we need to reconsider this. What does it mean to be educated? I remember Marshall McLuhan used to say, you know, those computers they have in the White House there, you know, the people who read the information coming off those computers, they can't be specialists. They have to be encyclopedists. I'll tell you, in the future, it's the people who are going to go places, they're going to be the people with the overview, because you can't any longer do this specialization. You know, I'd listen to him then, but I'm thinking about it now and get to reflect on what I heard then. So, okay, protests. We can talk about student protests. I think that was a substantial discussion on student protests. I asked myself, how many times does that happen where you have that much expertise and, you know, John Oxley and Professor Roncourt and Mark Spooner and Andy Davis, and, you know, this was substantial. I mean, it's not always smooth. It's not always free-flowing. It's not always just quite, you know, as snippety-snappity, but we've opened up a topic, and we're talking about protest, and we've put it in context. We've talked about walls. We've talked about the Great Wall of China. We've talked about the Berlin Wall. We've talked about a wall, which I'm calling the Wall of the War on Terror. That's a name that I'm coining. From the Berlin Wall to the Quebec Wall. When we were heading off to Quebec City, there was this this recognition that that they were putting up this wall, that they were blocking out the whole downtown Quebec, which I'd never seen before. You know, you can understand the need for security, and you can understand security around, you know, a building or a complex of buildings, but taking a whole downtown core of a major Canadian city, not just any Canadian city, but Quebec City, and the idea that as an Albertan or an Ontarian, you can go to Quebec City and walk the streets of Quebec City and you're at home there, right? Like, there would be some in Quebec who say, no, no, you're not at home here. This is our country. And if you come into our country, you better have a passport. You better have our permission. Hey, you know, that's one view. But to have freedom of movement in Quebec City was, you know, there's a lot of symbolism there, given that, you know, this is the site of the Plains of Abraham, the British conquest of Canada, and all of these issues. So that was a major topic at the time. So too was the tear gas. So I walked down to the fence with the big march. Somebody had brought a rope. We just all knew we'd pull on the rope. I mean, the fence was a symbol. I walked up to the front of the just by the fence, and people were pulling on the rope, and I said, it's not connected. I took it and connected it to the fence. We pulled it away and walked in, and walked right up to the Darth Vader figures there, and looked at their eyes, and I could see they were frightened. I could see they weren't about to do anything irrational or start beating people. And I walked down and 100 yards in, walked back, then suddenly tear gas hits. And I thought it was coming from the protesters, because, you know, that's the way it was being thrown. And it was, actually, but the tear gas was being fired at the protesters, and they would pick it up and throw it back the other way, which is a pretty brave thing to do. Anyway, so then the tear gas hits. Have any of you ever experienced tear gas? It's very devastating. You breathe it in, and then you start to run, and then you breathe harder, and you just have a feeling you've got to get out of there or you're going to die. So everything goes haywire after the tear gas comes in. Now, Quebec City in 2001, this is your history. Like, this was the big moment of student protest in Canada. This is before 9/11. There was at least 20,000 post-secondary students there. I mean, everyone had to make special arrangements with their universities so they didn't have to got away around the exam, because it was right around the exam week. And this was a particularly interesting and committed group of young Canadians, a group of young Canadians that I feel proud in every way to have, you know, been with. Do you want to mention, Ashley? Yeah, so it was the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the effort to extend NAFTA to all of the Western Hemisphere. So the Chiapas Indians had made a stand in 1994, this became the subject of so much internet traffic. And then if you read the piece I've written in the Chronology on Tecumseh and Toussaint Louverture and the Trail of Tears, I'm trying to connect all of these issues. Essentially, I'm making this point again and again in different ways. Once the Pope donates the Western Hemisphere to Spain, it sets a precedent. You can just trade land of indigenous peoples without any reference to those indigenous peoples. Whether we talk about the Louisiana Purchase, or Hudson's Bay Company transferring to the Dominion of Canada, and the idea that we're doing this in 2001, we're doing it yet again, we're remaking the map of the Western Hemisphere, as if the indigenous peoples are, is it that they're subhuman, or what is the rationale for making this categorization between who can make international law treaties and who can't? And this, you know, applies to Africa. If you get to read about Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the slave revolt in San Domingo, the richest colony in the world at that time, and French Revolution, Liberté, égalité, fraternité, we're all equal, you know, down with tyrannies of all sorts, monarchy, clergy. Black slaves in a French colony see this, and they rise up against it. Napoleon crushes them, tries to crush them. They create the Republic of Haiti. So this monopolization of international lawmaking, essentially by Europeans and then their progeny, the United States of America. This is a great theme of history to me. How do you make this distinction? Why is it that Africans had no say in what's how Africa is going to be divided? And maybe we could explain this in terms of the preoccupations of Victorian times and how Victorians looked at it. But if we do this in our own time, given what we know, anyway, that was my issue, and I wrote about it, and I was honored with a visit by the head of the National Security Investigation Section here in the University of Lethbridge, and then we went to Quebec City, and then we had the conference, and then the next day we have the march. And so I'm trying to pick up the strain of what we were talking about last week, tie it into the issue of, you know, the deeper context of protest here. And anyway, this tear gas, government by its own reports acknowledged that they put 6,000 canisters of tear gas out. And I would question if there was ever an episode in North American history where that much tear gas was used. So this is the papers that I brought together for Amnesty International in trying to identify what, you know, my experiences through this. And I found this article in the Montreal Gazette, 22 April 2001. So it's talking about tear gas, and says in 1969, 80 countries voted to include tear gas agents among the chemical weapons banned under the Geneva Protocol. You read down here further, and it says, in vitro tests have shown that GES, which is the active agent in tear gas, can cause cell mutation. And of course, what is cancer but cell mutation? And then it says, contaminated clothing must be discarded. And I do not remember any official statement coming from any government saying, you know, don't just take your clothes home and put them in the laundry. You better destroy those clothes. So this was not a small thing to shoot 6,000 canisters of tear gas at the flower of your youth, at the people who care about the future of the country and are thinking about the future of the free trade area of the Americas and the Western Hemisphere. This was a very, you know, dedicated group. To have spent your own money to go, you know, down there, to have gotten out of exams or whatnot, this was a very high moment of Canadian experience and a Canadian experience of your generation. We took that. We were through the fence, and I must say that, you know, I'm describing the first 10 minutes when there was no tear gas and everything was pretty orderly, and I didn't see people going around sort of aimlessly or in a chaotic way, you know, breaking windows, and like there was a point to be made with the fence, and there was sort of minimal force to demonstrate we're not going to tolerate this you know. People with these ideas can be on this side of the fence. People with these other ideas must be on the, you know, must be fenced out. And there was at that time, if you were a big company, you could buy like a breakfast for the 34 heads of state. You know, for so much you could get a dinner. You know, the basic logic of the thing is the corporation smooths. Is the verb smooth, hang out, have drinks, you know, get to know each other. How's your family? Want to play golf? You know, that's how you network and you get insider access, and that's basically, you know, there's a case to be made. Hey, business is business, and this is the reality of the world. This is how we feed ourselves. This is how we create economic activity, let's not ignore that. We are the corporations. I mean, they feed us, they nourish us. I'm going to take 2 minutes just to finish this off. I know the time is up, but I'd mention that in 1997, there was kind of the preeminent model for this type of protest. in Vancouver at UBC in 1997. And this is the famous shot. This is Sergeant Pepper Spray. Huey Stewart, I think, is his name. And he was captured by the CBC spraying pepper spray on students. Now, there was an order from the Prime Minister of Canada to keep the students away from where the meetings were taking place. Essentially, the allegation was that Chrétien didn't want Suharto, who is a particularly sort of ruthless dictator, when he came to power, a million people were killed in Indonesia. So here is Suharto, East Timor and all the various violations in Indonesia are horrendous. So Canada, of course, Indonesia is a hugely important country, and their economics count for a lot. And so Canada needs to have economic relationships with it. Students were protesting this. And anyway, Craig Jones was one of those students. He did he became an informant for Terry Mieleski. And Craig Jones, in a word, here's how he explained. Our government bargained away the constitutional rights of Canadian citizens for no other reason than to appease the embarrassment concerns of President Suharto of Indonesia. So Craig Jones and the journalist Terry Mieleski worked together. This is from a story done by Terry Mieleski. And Terry Mieleski writes this article. And if I had more time, I'd read into the record specifically who Terry Mieleski is. He's one of the authors of an article in this book. This book is a series of articles. He was targeted by the RCMP and, he alleges, the Prime Minister's office, who worked in cahoots to discredit him. He was telling the story that essentially the laws of Canada are being violated by the police under the political direction of the Prime Minister's office, because police aren't there to do political jobs for politicians. Police are there to enforce the laws. The laws are supposed to apply to everybody equally. There's a constitution that says that you have freedom of expression, association. It doesn't say except where, there's a rich, a dictator of a rich country who we don't want to embarrass. So the importance of the role of police in these type of affairs, where police can intervene, if they're intervening for a political motivation, that has devastating implications for the integrity of the rule of law in a country. And so in 1997, there was a lot of attention. The fact that Mieleski writes this article to explain what happens, because he was essentially disgraced. He was taken off the story, and it turns out he was subjected to political intervention. The CBC, where does the CBC get its money from? How does the CBC retain its independence when it depends upon whoever is the governing party? Don't forget, the Reform Party, the Alliance Party, their policy was to abolish the CBC. And now they are the government of Canada. If the media of Canada is run exclusively by commercial enterprise, and we don't have at least one station where there's a motivation which is theoretically not to the bottom line, I mean, it's an American model. Eh? They don't have real public broadcasting in the United States. They have PBS, a few good shows, but it's nothing like CBC. So I hope then this gives you a better feel about how to use the 11-page course outline, which I've put more work into than I've ever put into any outline. The chronology is not in any way comprehensive. It's not done. It's something that I'm starting, and yet you can, there's a story. You want the story, globalization since 1492, what happened when. I hope it gives you some more sense of an anchor. And I'm sorry to go over a little bit, but thanks for your patience, and hopefully we go back out into the world with contacts to other folks. So thank you very much, and see you.